Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with something Malcolm X said. I believe that there will ultimately be a clash between the oppressed and those who do the oppressing. I believe that there will be a clash between those who want freedom, justice, and equality for everyone, and those who want to continue the system of exploitation. I believe there will be that kind of clash, but I don't think it will be based on the color of skin. And that was Malcolm X, who was murdered, assassinated, or executed, whichever perspective is customary, on February 21st, 1965. And now something I wrote, which I titled An Image of Dark, Angry Shadows, from someone else's headline of many years ago. Quite a number of years ago, a prestigious television personality, who was a white American, made a spurious gaffe in an interview with a reporter from a gay magazine. He said that most people are born with equal intelligence, but blacks have watered down their genes because the less intelligent ones are the ones that have the most children. Later on, he attempted to defend himself against heavy criticism. I said the least fit are proliferating, and I didn't say blacks. He claimed the quote was part of a campaign by homosexuals to discredit him, a known homophobe, which got him in more hot water. Whatever the imbroglio and its consequences, he was suspended from his TV network for a few months. And whether or not he was actually homophobic, or racist, or both, or just plain elitist, a champion of breeding only by persons of breeding, all capital letters. His fateful remarks pointed out an increasing perplexity of the world human population explosion, so far unaffected by the current plague pandemic. Humanity is more prolific than rats. Not entirely hyperbole, and as Abraham Lincoln famously said, God must love poor people because he made so many of them. Most of the world's children are poor and hungry, with little chance of education or sustaining employment in the best of times, not to mention chronic lack of food. The now posthumously unremembered non-celebrity was quite wrong, however, to attribute the problem of breeding solely to the people begetting children. After all, rich or poor, educated or illiterate, black, white, or etc., humanity's single, compelling, and insensate purpose, like all organic matter, is to breed, to instinctively and virtually mindlessly perpetuate the species, whether it is a good idea or not. The implication is that intelligent folk are losing genetic headway. They don't multiply as rapidly or numerously as the mentally or economically deficient, which, of course, puts the onus on people of races other than white, who are begatting recklessly and unfairly trumping whites in the numerical sweepstakes of racial supremacy. The remark that the least fit are proliferating does not probe the circumstances that might quantify some people less fit to reproduce than others. Impoverishment, malnutrition, chronic unemployment, lack of education, or the opportunity for education are major factors toward dissolving the potency of a community, a nation, a race. They are not the result of inferior genes, but of defective social and political philosophies, policies, and prejudices that might rightfully, though cautiously, be considered racial and or cultural genocide. The regressive and vengeful backlash of prejudice and oppression against American blacks for having dared challenge white supremacy, whether as slaves or free, is revealed as more insidious than mere colonialism or neo-apartheid if it is recognized that an underlying intent is indeed for them to breed themselves into hapless oblivion without primary means of mitigative support for survival. With few exceptions, American blacks are contained and isolated in urban ghettos or squalid, segregated rusticity in much the manner Nazis forced Jews into European ghettos. They are prejudicially police-enforced, denied adequate education, employment, housing, or adequate health care, forced to subsist on meager welfareism, repellently evaluated by the color of their skin. Black rage is forced inward against themselves. The barely constrained contempt xenophobic whites feel toward blacks is most likely equally felt toward racist whites by blacks who are victims of the antipathy, but outnumbered 10-1 and without the tremendous armament and legal power of the whites, they are generally unable to strike back without horrible consequences. The prevailing white attitude toward blacks was summed up by Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Roger Taney, in 1857, when, speaking for the majority in the Dred Scott case, he stated that Negroes were considered, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, unquote. Not all whites are supremacists. Whites have fought and some have died for civil rights for blacks, though most are racist, if not intentionally, usually on impact. Separate standards exist to the point of contrariety. Somehow it is okay for a white to be lethally armed, but dangerous if a black carries a gun or knife. The Ku Klux Klan and its penchant for lynching and overall anti-black atrociousness can be, if not forgiven, at least explicable to the white power structure. Black power, expressed currently through Black Lives Matter, is, however, a substantial threat to white righteousness. The retrogressive racism that emanated from the White House the past 4 years under the xenophobic apartheid hypocrisy of Donald Trump demonstrates exactly why recognition of Black History Month is more urgently relevant than since its overdue ratification in 1976, 2 centuries following the incubation of Yankee Doodle USA, and a century after the Civil War abolished slavery, which the founders were reluctant to do. Commemorating Black History Month this year has a great amount of real solidarity behind it. Hundreds of thousands of white Americans truly walked the walk and stood up against the deviant atrocities and violence against Black Americans perpetrated by Donald Trump, especially Trump's desperately criminal intent to invalidate black votes against his reelection as president, which truly disenfranchised his spurious claims that the election was stolen from him. Black lives do matter, and black votes do count. Yet the prospect of continuing civil insurrection exemplified by the fanatic attack upon the nation's capital looms. And the true test of democracy is staked on racial multiplicity and not on white nationalism. Police murders of blacks were a direct cause of Black Lives Matter, which resulted much of this past year in mass street demonstrations throughout the USA, lasting for months, which in turn spurred more violence against blacks and their determined white supporters, and despite the raging pandemic. Donald Trump's white supremacy vision of America directly showed its two-faced iron fist, particularly in Portland, Oregon. Official violence was countered with hard protest, but of course it was unequal. The only real surprise was the massive and enduring support of whites on the side of blacks, which drove home the truth that black Americans are indispensable to democratic culture, and no political or racist subterfuge is able to alter that reality. Trump's attempt at wholesale invalidation of black votes has been a real example of cancel culture. These final few days of 2021 Black History Month document the astounding reversal of Donald Trump's viciously racist and undemocratic presidency as a result of black suffrage. Positive proof that black lives and their votes matter very much. And that was a screed that I wrote and rewrote a few times in earlier versions aired on this program. And now, something written by David Horowitz, Professor Emeritus of History at Portland State University, these last 50 years. Something he wrote, Tales of the North Coast Klan. 97 years ago, in the summer of 1924, Clatsop County was proud to host the statewide convention of the Ku Klux Klan of the realm of Oregon. Between 5,000 and 10,000 Oregonians gathered at a Klan celebration in Astoria, welcomed to the North Coast by the city's mayor, a friend of the secret order. Klansmen proudly marched in public procession through the streets of Astoria and Seaside, conducted naturalization ceremonies to induct an additional 150 members, and gathered for the dedication of new Klan headquarters in the county seat. The Ku Klux Klan even sponsored the runner-up candidate in that July's Miss Astoria pageant. Nationwide membership in the Ku Klux Klan peaked between 2 and 3 million in the mid-1920s. Oregon had the highest per capita Klan membership of any state in the Union, and Clatsop County followed Portland with the second highest Klan membership in the state. One-fourth of the adults in the county may have been enrolled in the Klan and its auxiliaries. Re-established in 1915, the second Ku Klux Klan confined membership to native-born white Protestant males who took secret oaths of loyalty to the order. Klan literature boasted of the organizations dedicated to pure womanhood, white supremacy, the Constitution, uncorrupted religion, freedom of speech, the common people, and public education. Klan polemics focused on the need to assimilate foreigners, non-Protestants, non-whites, and political radicals to the American way. When moral supervision proved ineffective, Klansmen frequently resorted to other methods. Although acts of outright terrorism and violence actually were rare in the 1920s, local claverns often employed economic boycotts, social ostracism, and political pressure to accomplish their aims. Klan organizers built on long-standing animosities toward Roman Catholics in Oregon to create a powerful movement in the early 1920s. The election of 1922 produced a Democratic governor elected with Klan support and a voters' initiative which nearly abolished Oregon's private and parochial schools. The compulsory education measure, subsequently ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court, would have required children between the ages of 8 and 18 to attend public schools. One school, one flag, one language, Klan organizers proclaimed in the successful grassroots campaign. Klan influence in the state legislature also produced a 1923 bill prohibiting ownership of land by aliens. Oregon Governor Walter Pierce acknowledged as a fellow Klansman when he appeared at a secret meeting of the La Grande Clavern in 1922, gladly signed the land bill. Although the Ku Klux Klan played upon ethnic and cultural hostilities to build a powerful fraternal organization and political movement, Klansmen genuinely appeared to be concerned with the moral tenor of life in the burgeoning 1920s. What concerned them in particular was the growing cosmopolitan nature of America's cities and towns and urban culture's increasing neglect of the moral values of the past. This great drama took on intense proportions in the two centers of Oregon's North Coast, Tillamook and Astoria. Tillamook County's Klan organizations listed 195 members on its rolls in mid-1926. Many were substantial dairy farmers, retail merchants, and professional people from every population center between Nehalem and Hebo. The Tillamook Tavern engaged in the patronage and financial activities typical of a fraternal organization with substantial political priorities. It dutifully sold subscriptions for the Oregon Klan's Western American newspaper. It collected dues, money for Klan roads, and contributions for Klan charities, nearly $400 during March 1924. It also encouraged Tillamook County members to support the candidacy of a local American Legion commander for director of the state mental institution. This is the first political appointment that Tillamook has ever asked for, and we deserve this one, local Klan leaders exhorted their following. Klan officials in Tillamook avoided ethnic issues and attacks on Catholics. But in Astoria and Clatsop County, KKK moral concerns merged more directly with the nativist movement so strong in Northwest culture. The Astoria Clavern attracted 900 members at its peak and a total of 2,000 between 1920 and 1926. Native-born hostility to Catholics and the Finnish community worked to give Klan candidates a sweep in the 1922 city elections. Klan support contributed to victories for the new mayor, four newly created city commission spots, and the county sheriff. But when the newly appointed city manager refused to cooperate with Klan patronage plans, the order pushed its political power by instigating a recall campaign through petition. This was going too far for most native-born Astorians sympathetic to Klan goals. The city manager was able to counter the Klan purge by linking it to outside interests. "We don't need Portland men to tell us how to run our business," he proclaimed in effective response to Klan harassment. Astoria's feisty city manager may have been the only man in town to publicly defy the Ku Klux Klan. A Catholic attorney was forced to end a speech at a 1922 meeting of the Astoria Law Enforcement League when he accused the Klan of divisiveness. "You can't say anything against the Ku Klux Klan from the rostrum," objected the pastor of the host Methodist church. The circulation manager of the evening newspaper then reinforced the minister's protest. "I am one of the wardens of the church. You know this church is anti-Catholic. I won't allow you to speak as you have been talking." The morning newspaper headlined, "Squabble at Purity Meet." Native-born Astorians were even more threatened by the city's large Finnish community. In the aftermath of World War I, Astoria veterans formed an American Legion post in 1919. Its motto was, "Alien slackers must go," and it attempted to arrange the deportation of foreign men who had not served in the war, particularly Finns. At one point, the Legion tried to pressure one of the local canneries to fire a suspect Finnish worker, but the company refused. The veterans also attacked the editors of the Finnish language newspaper for failing to publish wartime ads for the Red Cross and the Liberty Bond campaign. Suspicion concerning the loyalty of the Finns created a perfect climate for the Klan crusade to rid the region of foreign influence and preserve a culture familiar to native-born Americans. During the 1922 initiative drive to ban parochial schools, Astoria teachers formed a One Language, One People committee. Its goals reflected Klan desires to teach Americanism and stress the importance of speaking English. Newspaper reports indicate that Astoria school authorities gagged a Finnish boy for 3 months during classes to demonstrate the evils of speaking the foreign tongue. In another incident, a girl was expelled from school for speaking Finnish over the telephone. She had been speaking to her non-English speaking mother after her father had been injured in an accident and sent to the hospital. Klan authorities connected the alien problem to their anxieties over moral stability in a changing culture. The pages of the Western American, the official state newspaper of the KKK, reflected this concern in pointed language. Published in Astoria by Lem Deaver for several months in 1922, before relocation in Portland, Western American editorials lectured subscribers on Klan moral and political duties. Immorality and degeneracy were increasing in America, Deaver warned 3 weeks after the 1922 elections. He argued that love of money and the natural depravity of the human mind were responsible. The church had lost its appeal and power, he complained. The people were to be found at the movies, mad for pleasure, power, ostentation, and class, quote unquote. The Klan's mission, an accompanying editorial preached, was to Americanize the alien hordes which infested the country. A Klan statement in the same issue summed up the findings of nativist sociology. The greatest danger facing the American Republic today is the gradual replacement of our religious, social, and political foundations by those of alien origin. The Astoria Klan saw itself as a purity crusader in an increasingly secular society. Newspapers reported that a group of Klansmen marched into a meeting in the basement of the Astoria Methodist Church in May 1922 and left an $80 contribution. The money was to go to the building of a children's home in Corvallis, a project of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. By the end of 1923, when Deaver broke with the Oregon Klan, membership had peaked both in Clatsop County and in most parts of the state. Only in Tillamook County, where the Klan functioned primarily as a fraternal order, did KKK activity carry on substantially into the latter 1920s. The 1920s Ku Klux Klan, unlike its more violent, racially intolerant successors following World War II, was a fraternal order and political machine whose emphasis lay with moral character, quote unquote, and the values associated with native-born Protestants. The Klan provided its adherents with a way to force cultural change in a spirit of ethnic and social solidarity. The narrowness of its focus is obvious, the potential for bigotry and intolerance enormous. Yet, as William Toll has suggested in his own scholarship, the 1920s Ku Klux Klan of the North Coast spoke to those frightened by the social and moral consequences of modernization. Klan crusades proved divisive and carried the potential for unwarranted hate against those who had their own moral codes and traditions. Nevertheless, North Coast Klansmen, like other Americans of the 1920s, found themselves trying to resolve the knotty contradictions between economic growth and its unsettling consequences. One can never condone bigotry and cultural intolerance, but those who follow history can certainly appreciate the dilemmas which plagued our predecessors, even if they did not resolve them in ways which stir reverence and pride. And that was Tales of the North Coast Klan by David Horowitz, who is Professor Emeritus of History at Portland State University. His article about the North Coast KKK is a public presentation of research under the auspices of a grant from the Oregon Committee for the Humanities. This is Michael McCusker. Engineer for this program is Dylan Hauser-Schulk. As a long-standing tribal member of Radical Radio Ranters, I feel obliged to comment on the recent death of Rush Limbaugh, the maestro of hate radio, who succumbed to cancer rather than his own bilious bile. I can do no better than echo Free Speech TV's Stephanie Miller, whose response to her mother's admonishment to speak only good of the dead, "Rush Limbaugh is dead," Stephanie said. "Good," she said. And in regard to the raging pandemic that has now exceeded 500,000 dead Americans, this from Bobby Lipman's weekly column in the Newport, Oregon News Times. "It took click it or ticket to get people to wear seatbelts," she wrote. "I wonder if mask it or casket might work for the pandemic. So continue to lock down and mask up. Get vaccinated when it's your turn. Protecting yourself protects everybody else." I close with profound regret that the immortal Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty became mortal this past Monday.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down my heavy load.
I know my rope's going to fit to me well.
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load.
I tried it on at the gates of hell.
I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
And fair,
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load.
Why not take my wings and cleave the air?
I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy.
Get to heaven, gonna sing and shout.
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load.
There's nobody there